Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 314. I'm joined this week by May Martin. It's a great chat. I really enjoyed this. Thank you all for tuning in, by the way. And thank you for all the love for recent episodes. I had a bonus episode on Friday with comedian Rich Wilson, and that went down an absolute treat. But a couple of weeks ago, I had Michael Cashman on, and the reaction to that podcast is just continuing to be insane. Michael Cashman was on. I wanted to get that podcast out in February because it's LGBT plus History Month. And Michael Cashman is a key figure in the UK for LGBT law changes, perception, everything. So if you missed that one, seriously, go back and give it a look. You might not be aware of who Michael Cashman is, but it'll blow your mind. I mean, it's also good that May Martin is sneaking in as the last guest of February, which, as said, is LGBT History Awareness Month, because she's got a great new show called Feel Good that covers some LGBT topics. I mean, you'll hear about it as we discuss it, because they're really... In fact, you'll also hear... I've done this once or twice in the past, but and people have moaned, so I want to explain in the intro. This podcast is 100% a safe place for discussion on all topics without question of, or without attack for asking questions or being curious. But when I have someone on I don't know yet, and May is that person, I'm a big fan of her. It was lovely to hear that she was a fan of the podcast, and it was kind of a mutual excitement about coming on. But because of that, if we're discussing stuff like LGBT rights and depression and addiction and these heavy subjects, I'll often pose a question, and then before the guest can answer, I'll give my view on it, kind of thing. And that may sound weird and arrogant, but the reason for that is it's a genuine approach I use that seems to work, and I think it worked wonderfully in this episode. It's to make the guest feel comfortable talking about their views on it. If they're not familiar with the podcast or familiar with the comfort and relaxation and the ability to go back and forth and have a discussion and a debate on a sensitive subject, if it's someone you've never met, if they ask you a big question or a heavy topic or heavy subject, you know, you might not feel comfortable really getting into it or responding. So, as said, a technique I've used in the past that works well, and I think works well here, is to be the first one to jump on that grenade, as such, you know, to put my kind of view out there and allow them to counter it or agree or whatever else. And yeah, I just wanted to kind of explain that in advance, because I don't do it loads, but I know that when it's a bigger subject, I'll do that as a kind of... And it's a caution. I'm fucking nervous about talking about things in the modern day and age where people get cancelled for asking a question and stuff like that. But anyway, I'm rambling on a lot now. It's a wonderful chat, and it's actually really relaxed. I'm making it sound as if it was super tense. It's, considering it's someone I've never met, it's one of the most relaxed I've been and we've been. It was a really good chat, and it felt as if we could have chatted for ages. I've been a fan of May's comedy for a while now, and I got to preview her show Feel Good, which is on Channel 4 in March, and it blew me away. But you'll hear about all of that. I'll tell you quickly before I go, next week's guest is Niamh Algar, which is worth mentioning because May Martin's new show is a Channel 4 show. I became exposed to Niamh Algar in two Channel 4 shows, The Bisexual, which interestingly we talk about in this episode, but more so The Virtues, which quite rightfully won a shed load of awards last year. So yeah, that's next week's guest. But for now, let's have a listen. I'm not even going to do any of my usual plugs. I'm not going to mention speechdevelopmentrecords.com. I'm not going to mention that I've got a new glow-in-the-dark vinyl of the Distraction Pieces album available there. And I'm not going to mention patreon.com/scroobiouspip, because I want to get into the episode. So this is episode 314 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with May Martin. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Exciting. We're going.
Great.
It's all happening. Hello, I'm here today with Mae Martin. How are you?
I'm really well, thanks. Nice to finally meet you.
Yes, and you. I've been enjoying your stuff for a long while. And
that's so nice. Thank you. Ditto.
Excellent. And ahead of this chat, I got sent some preview links of your new show, Feel Good. And often you'll kind of go, I'll try and watch a couple of episodes and get it kind of started. But I smashed through the whole series
loved
it. I thought it was really good. So
I really hope that people binge it, so that's good. I think it works best binged.
Completely. So last night, as we recalled this, you had kind of the first public screenings of it.
Yeah.
How was that? Because it is, and we'll get into it, but it's personal.
Yeah.
And even regardless of any personalness, anything that is your creation, it's so much work before there's any confirmation that it's good.
Yeah, man. You know it's been, I mean? Yeah.
Because so the first time you get it in the public, it must be nerve-wracking and exciting
totally,
at the same time.
Because it was a five-year process, really. And we made a pilot years ago that went in the bin. And so for years, we've just been working in this vacuum and hoping that what we're doing is good. So it was so scary. And then people laughed, and that was good. And, I was absolutely bricking it, though.
I love it. Again, it's mad because particularly as a five-year process, and particularly if there were versions that got thrown out and stuff like that, it must be so hard to know if it's funny. More so with comedy. With drama, I think it's probably easier to go, right, we know we're getting these dramatic bits. But when there's comedy in there, you're so insulated. And by the time you've done 10 takes of it and then you've probably been watching edits and rushes and cuts, it must be really hard to tell if there's laughs. So,
and it's kind of a weird tone too. So we didn't know. We hoped that, like, we were really trying to make it a comedy drama in the truest sense, where it's properly funny, and then we'll suddenly be really sad. So, but you worry that then maybe it's too sad, and people won't get that it's supposed to be funny. Yeah. But luckily, I think there were big laughs.
100%. And again, I think it's great that because I think TV is evolving hugely at the moment, but I still think it's got a way to go at times, and it can be really hard to get projects off the ground when they are in that grey area of real drama and comedy and all these things. But because, I mean, Channel 4 are one of my favourite companies out there, but I'm sure they've still got a comedy department and a drama department.
Mm-hmm.
So it starts to be, right, if it's not punchlines every 10 minutes, is it going to entice the comedy department? And if it's too light, is it going to entice the drama department? It can be a real limbo of, of development.
And I think because it was a co-production with Netflix and Channel 4, so I think that was helpful because Netflix are all about the drama, and so they were often, their notes were about pushing the drama, and then Channel 4 were about the comedy, so it was a good balance. And then but it is interesting, even like they're editing trailers together now, and so it's interesting seeing what bits they choose and what tone they think will attract people. But I just hope people watch it.
It's such a weird one on picking. Like, I can't even imagine the process of trailers for a show like this, because like with music, it was always that weirdness of, well, we need to have a first single, but the single isn't going to represent the album if you're doing anything a bit unusual. So that must be tenfold with a series, because it's six episodes. There's so many ups and downs and changes in tone. So how's that been?
Like, if you go for the broadest joke, then people are going to think that's the tone. It's a delicate balance.
Have you found that over the years in comedy as well? Because again, it's that kind of, as a comedian, you probably, my thought from seeing other comedians is you start out thinking, I want as many people there as possible, because that's a good gig. And then you realise you want as many of the right people there as possible, rather than just a full room. And the Saturday night comedy crowd might not necessarily be as enjoyable as a reasonably busy Wednesday night room of comedy fans.
I think that's why I moved to England partly rather than the States, because I'm from Canada, and I love how the comedy scene structured here because of Edinburgh, that people are totally up for listening to an hour, and they're up for going on a thing that has kind of a narrative arc, or you don't have to have an insanely high gag ratio, because the in the States, I mean, I think this is changing now with things like Nanette, and things are hours are becoming, and Netflix specials and things like that, But it used to be that you just polish a 20-minute club set, and then you do that same set for a year, and then you do a new one, and you're pushing for a late night slot, which is like a 5-minute thing, yeah. And I'm just terrible at that. It's such a discipline and a skill set I don't have. So yeah. I'm way more suited to like an hour of settling in, getting deep. You know,
it's mad, and it is an interesting one, because if you're from the UK, you kind of, and into comedy at all, you know of how Edinburgh works, and it all seems normal and natural. But every American I know that comes over to it, comedians or musicians or whatever, are like, what is this place?
They're like, what are you doing? You're retiring a new hour of material every year.
Yeah.
Going up, losing thousands of pounds. Like, it is a crazy system, but it's
one of the most beautiful and heartbreaking things about it is the retiring an hour part of it is I'll go and see a show on the Free Fringe or wherever else and think, oh man, there's such beauty and sorrow in the fact that that's the only time it might exist.
Yeah.
It might be the best thing I've ever seen, but if you're not at that top level where it's being recorded for Netflix or whatever else, it existed there, and then a short run, if you're lucky, maybe the Soho Theatre will pick it up for a couple of nights. But other than that, it exists there, and then it's gone.
I know.
I love it and hate it, though, because that is beautiful as well.
Yeah.
It does trouble me that society now is so much on demand and everyone wants to have access to everything. It's kind of nice that there are some things that
are ephemeral like that. And also that live experience can be so pure. Like, I'm thinking, as you said that, I'm like going through this Rolodex of like religious experiences that I've had at the Fringe, watching amazing shows that will never be seen again. Like Dr. Brown, some of those shows, or John Kearns, some of his.
And Dr. Brown was one of the ones I'd always go and see when I was up there. He's just,
you feel like you're really having an experience just with that audience and just with him, that is just for who is in the room.
And it's one of the rare bits of comedy that isn't pretentious, but it does feel like you're watching art as well. Yeah. You get to feel smug about yourself going, wow, that was quite a thing. And it's like, it's just
I've
hilarious.
Grown as a person, And he's in my show. He plays the, we wrote that part for him and named it Phil because he's called Phil Burgers, and just hoped that he'd do it.
I didn't even realise or recognise at all. That's amazing. Yeah, I've watched his Dr. Brown stuff so many times and never, that didn't click at all.
Yeah, he has this amazing face on camera. And because a lot of his comedy is silent. He doesn't speak in it. So
yeah, exactly.
It's amazing. He's actually an incredible actor, and
he's fantastic. So this is kind of a three-tiered question.
I love that.
how have you found it moving or getting across stand-up in the room to then doing a Netflix special on the Comedians of the World stuff and then putting it into a TV show? So it feels like three completely different arts and crafts there, because there's so much that doesn't translate on a special, but then I guess if you've done that and felt that some stuff didn't translate, you then get to control it more as a fictional drama. But there is a lot of stand-up in the show still. So how are those three stages, I guess?
I think you're right that they're connected. And definitely, I started with an hour-long show called Dope, and then that all those themes and stuff were the ones that people seemed to take to in a way they hadn't before with my comedy. And so that was exciting. And then that became the half hour special. So that was like trimming all the fat off it and all the, in fact, taking a lot of the poignancy out of it too, and trying to make it a tighter, more accessible half hour of jokes.
It's the accessibility that becomes challenging when you're suddenly, again, opening up to a big audience rather than your crowd in that room.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. And then narrativizing it was exciting because you get to think about everyone else's perspectives and all those other characters instead of just your own boring narcissism.
Yeah.
It's like thinking about girlfriends I've had and other relationships in my life and how they might feel. And so that was juicy. I think I've always wanted to do that.
Yeah. I mean, that's what is I love about it is all the different angles and perspectives. Kind of every character in the show has points of evil and points of beauty.
Oh,
like,
I'm glad.
Even like, again, the best friend of the girl who becomes your partner in it. That's not a big spoiler. It happens quite quickly.
Yeah.
It's a spoiler of the first 5 minutes or so. But I don't think I've despised anyone as much on screen in a long time. But then there's a point towards the end where it is kind of flipped a little bit and feels far more human, but in a realistic way. It doesn't feel like kind of, I love Breaking Bad, but I got tired towards the end of it that it was going constantly from Walter White being this badass, and then no, he's a good guy again, and then he's a bad. It's started to lose the reality there. But this felt true there. So how was that to kind of be open about the negative sides, maybe of your own or your character's personality, and the positive sides of people that you would probably demonize as a stand up at a gig? Someone who's on their phone, or someone who's talking, or someone who's heckling. It's easy to go, oh, I can write them as an absolute piece of shit. This is great. Yeah. But then to find the positive and their angle on it.
I think we tried to just think about everyone's bringing so much baggage into every moment of their lives. And and we really have no idea what lens people are seeing the world through based on their experience and all their personal wounds. And even someone like that character you're talking about, Binky, is like this super privileged, posh kind of, but of course she has her own insecurities and demons. And I think it's, we tried to make it nuanced in that way. And I tried to be harsh about myself as well. And but that's what life is, isn't it?
Yeah, completely. And again, it is realistic, because we see everything through our lens. So if someone is being a bitch, then we will see them as that. And then it can be as simple, because again, I don't want to give anything away, but with that one and with the businessman, it's one line of dialogue each time that makes you go, guess. And it's so, I love the simplicity of that, rather than this long, here's pulling back the curtain. It's a simple line of no, this, and you go,
that's nice.
Yeah, I guess that's...
I remember reading this story about... So there's this woman and she moves into a house, and then she's looking out her window and her neighbor's just moved in, and her neighbor's hanging up their laundry, and all the laundry's like streaked with shit. And she's like horrified and judging her neighbors and just like, what is this? What is this mess? And complaining to her husband. Then she eventually calls the police, because she's like, this family, all their laundry is just covered in shit all the time. And then the policeman comes in and is like, your window is covered in shit. And so she'd been looking through a dirty lens, right?
Yeah, I love that.
I think we do that so often. We have no idea how jaundiced our lens is. And it's good to examine that, I think.
How easy / good / damaging was it examining, I guess, yourself in this role? Because it's not a direct biographical story, but it's based on stuff that you've gone through and stuff that you've been through. And there is some real trauma over sexuality and realizations of sexuality and your approach to relationships, and there's addiction and stuff like that. So how was it kind of having to face that on a regular basis, on drafts and redrafts? Could you distance yourself, or was it kind of...
It was helpful writing with I wrote with my best friend Joe, and that was helpful. I think if I was on my own, I would have spiraled into some kind of madness, but he's very measured and very structure focused, and so it was easier to step back and look at it like that. But then particularly the some of the addiction and coke stuff was hard, and I hadn't really thought about that. I'd been so worried about the sex scenes and being nervous and being exposed in that way that I've been obsessing over that, and it just didn't occur to me really about how it would feel to be snorting some white powder, and that was shit.
I can imagine.
But it was all right. I can't complain. I've put myself in this situation.
I was going to say,
pretty masochistic.
Was there having to be a balance? Yeah, in may the writer and may the actor. Because writing, you've got to write what's right for the scene, what's going to be amazing, what's going to be powerful. But then you're also going to have a point where you go, I've got to do this.
I think.
Do I want to do this? Well, yeah. Do I want to cut this out or change this? Because I don't know if I want to do this. If it was someone else, I'd almost feel more comfortable saying, here it is, you're a professional, you play this role. But when you know it's for yourself.
100%. I think because I'd never really acted before, I didn't know how it would feel. So I was like, I'll do that. And then now I'm like, I wonder if we're starting to write more scripts and imagining. I mean, it hasn't been recommissioned yet, we're thinking about what it would be. And I wonder if I'll approach it differently, knowing what that felt like sometimes. And I just have to be careful I don't like censor myself, because I'm now like, oh fuck, that was scary. I think I was lucky that I'd never really done anything like that, so I thought, oh yeah, be fine.
I love it. And a weird sentence, but the sex scenes were some of my favorite scenes.
Oh, thanks.
Because we haven't really seen human, at points comedic, at points awkward sex scenes from any kind of LGBT community. The Bisexual, I think, had some, and that's one of my favourite series of recent years. But you, I mean, they're fairly regular. The kind of the awkward moments and the discomforts and the insecurities. And that felt important to see on screen because it doesn't feel as if they're trying to force an agenda or make a big statement. They're just human of things that people go through. And that, yeah.
Like they only come up in the script. I mean, there's only really two. There's a lot of kissing, but there's only really two sex scenes in it. But they were always so crucial narratively. Like they had to move the plot forward somehow. So hopefully there's no moment where it's like some voyeuristic, like you just step back and watch people banging. Like it had to be pretty intimate and often like painfully awkward, and which sex can be, and it's a show about a relationship, so it's going to come up. But yeah, oh, I'm glad you like those. I think
It's great because as well, it's things like nerves over sexual performance, over again, like one of the things that comes up is not being able to come, which is in
so common
straight relationships. It's talked about all the time, and it's this major thing. I've never thought about it at all with two women.
Yeah,
And it's completely a natural and huge thing. But it's, it felt wonderful to. It felt, I don't know, the way it's presented again. I loved all of these big topics are presented in quite a throwaway manner, and I mean that in the best way possible. That it's like, here's just this. Here's what's going on, rather than here's the big drama over this moment. Are you ready for it, the general public?
Yeah,
we're
going
to expose you to some stuff. It's going, no, this is day to day. This doesn't have to be.
Yeah, because it is just day to day in my life. So, yeah, that, and I think we try to, like, often when you see, especially with two women, those sex scenes and things, they're so, like, tender and exploratory, and they're usually written by a man or a straight person, so they're they're really beautiful and quite fit. But actually, girls are horny and they bang, and they have these characters. Is one of the only things they have in common is that they like having sex with each other because they're so different.
Yeah.
So I think it was important to show that because they're addicted to each other. So you had to show that element of it. Yeah,
I love that. And how important was it to you to get good representation of originally I wrote it down as the gay scene, but it isn't strictly that. It's of life as a gay person, because it's not contained in the gay scene. It's outside of it. It's dealing with people who don't know you're gay, dealing with people who don't know they're gay, and just all sorts of things like that. So how important was that to kind of go, let's shine a light on something that people don't really know too much about?
Well, I think not important. It wasn't something that because I think like there have been lots of shows about the gay scene, so like Queer as Folk and the L Word and stuff. But really, in my life, I don't even have many gay friends, and not on purpose, but just because I'm so in the comedy scene and I moved to England and those became my friends. And so it was just an honest depiction of my experience of being in the UK, which is like I hang out with straight male comedians or my best friends. And I date women often who haven't been with girls before. And so I hope that it's just one, like mainly we're like, we want to tell a show about addiction and I'm the main character, so it's like going to be a part of it, you know, the gay bit. But I hope, because the characters are not very comfortable with themselves, and there's a lot of ambiguity, and they're not. I don't think they even know how they identify, and there's a lot of fluidity. So I hope it's like raises interesting questions.
Well, how was it to kind of in your stand up, you will be playing yourself up there, or you'll be yourself up there kind of thing, and in that instance you can get across a lot of thoughts, a lot of ideas, a lot of theories on society
really directly that, you can just say them
really direct, and that's it. There was elements of that in this which I thought was great, but then I'm watching it thinking, oh, I'd like to discuss that more, and I'm like, oh no, is that the views of May the character, or May the writer, you know, things like that. So was that a fun part to kind of go, right, without it feeling false, let's get some little statements in and some little beliefs and stuff like that.
Yeah, there's definitely, I'm trying to think of, definitely in that breakup, oh, that's a spoiler, but whatever.
Yeah.
And And in some of the stand-up, maybe in that
same
episode. Yeah,
there was a bit, again, a bit that I liked, because, again, it's something I feel I'm straight because that's the world I grew up in and was exposed to. And there's a line where you're saying that you feel that everyone is bisexual or along a gradient of bisexuality, essentially. And things like that, I was like, I find that fascinating, but never hear it discussed.
Yeah.
It always seems, I don't know, these taboo subjects now have no longer become taboo. They've become conflicting sides of a battle.
Right,
and
yeah.
They can't be discussed because if you ask a question, then you're against and all that kind of thing. And it's, yeah.
It's so politicized, isn't it?
Yeah.
And like even in promoting it, it's been like sometimes quite highly charged in the conversations. But yeah, it's like bisexuality is, I guess both the characters in this are bi.
Yeah.
And they... Yeah, I guess that I remember reading years ago that the definition of bisexuality is recognizing within yourself the potential to be attracted to more than one gender, not necessarily to the same degree and not necessarily at the same time. It's such a broad definition. I think so many people fit into that.
Yeah.
For sure, there's people at either ends of the spectrum who are fully gay and fully straight, but I think like most people I know can be like, oh, I had a crush on that person, or I had a sex dream, or I have... Yeah, so I think it's crazy. We're just so... afraid of the labels. That's why I think the way forward is to get rid of them.
Yeah, I completely agree. So one of the notes I've got, and it's interesting that you were saying you'd not really acted before this, but you're really good at playing yourself. And
thanks.
That's something that is something that people can overlook because it can be really hard. Like we were discussing before we started that a mutual friend of ours had written a TV show and based one character on someone, that person came in and auditioned and couldn't play themselves.
Yeah.
Because it is a weird jump because it sounds easy to play yourself, but what you're doing day to day is speaking naturally and what comes into your head. And
yeah.
Often quite unplanned, particularly on podcasts. but what you're doing when you're playing yourself in something is saying these written words, planned out words, and it can be more jarring than if you're playing a character. So yeah, how did you find that? I thought it was amazing how natural it felt and how it didn't feel
like
you weren't experienced in it, if that makes
sense. Oh, that's really nice, because I have no idea how I'm in a vacuum still, so yeah. I don't know, but I think definitely it was the hardest character to write. Like it was a lot easier to think about George's perspective or my girlfriend in it or my sponsor. But I think my co-writer and I just really tried to, in writing it, think of it as a separate character and think of that emotional arc and how to tell a really satisfying emotional story where someone goes from point A to point B and adhere to the rules of storytelling. So that helped, because obviously life is not organized in that nice way or tied up with a bow like that. So when you have to impose a order onto chaos like that, it kind of forces you to distill things into a character.
And how was it to kind of litter in stories and tales and moments and realities from your real disorganized life into this planned arc of this, like, here, we can have this happen here. This did happen to me, but it happened 5 years away from what we're actually talking about there, but it fits there and goes in nicely.
Yeah, really satisfying and really
fun.
Put some
order in your own history as
exactly, yeah. I think so many people that...
It should have gone this way round.
Yeah.
Let's rearrange it.
I mean, music must be similar in a way in that you're taking kind of chaotic feelings and then it is kind of cathartic to see them all and presented in a way that's, that
it's
makes
exactly
more sense
how I've always
of it.
Done music is... I always say, because people assume all of my music is all non-fiction.
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's all fiction. It's drawing from real emotions and real moments, but then making a fictional story, and it all fit in here and make this thing, and it allows you to be that open and honest, I guess.
Yeah.
And again, there's a lot of honesty in this show, but I'd imagine because it's a fictional narrative, it allows you to be even more non-fiction,
totally.
I guess, than you would if it was this straight, here's how my life happened.
Yeah, because it's the...
Sit down, here's what happened in my life, I've got to tell you.
Because, like, the real honesty is about the feelings. So, yeah, you can take a really real and really raw emotion and then think, how do I narrativize that or fictionalize it? And then, even though the events might be masked or whatever, the truth of that emotion's there. Yeah, You're right. It can totally be more honest than if you like. There's this Stephen King novella, The Body, that Stand By Me was based on.
Right.
And it's a great little like autobiographical. It's so different to all his other stuff. But he always said that it's about a group of boys coming of age and they go to find a dead body.
Right.
He was like, I had to put the dead body in there to allow me to get into the like really real emotions with these boys,
right,
and to have it be more honest. And without that, so he had to throw in a crazy genre thing to be that honest. You know what I mean?
I love that though. You just have to throw in one lie and you can be more honest than anything in the world ever. Because it's like, well, that never happened. I never found a dead body.
Yeah.
So this isn't about me.
Totally. Yeah.
Everything else in it is 100% my emotions and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's really interesting. Well, I mean, as I'm sure a lot of the press interviews you've had have done, I've banged on about LGBT stuff for the first half of this chat, but it's not really about that. It is a show about addiction.
Thanks.
It just happens to have gay relationships in it and other relationships, but it's a show about addiction. So more than the kind of exposure, I guess, of sex scenes, of relationship emotions, how was it going down that route of addiction and the effect it has on the individual, on those around the individual, on the family of the individual? How was that to kind of jump into and try and tell that story honestly?
It's something I'm really interested in. Had done a lot of stand-up about, and obviously I've thought about a lot in my life in like processing my own adolescence and experiences and stuff. So yeah, it was super interesting. And there's a guy called Gabor Mate who's like an addiction specialist, and we use some of his definition of addiction is something that you crave and find relief in and do compulsively despite knowing intellectually the negative consequences that it's having. And
yeah,
I think so many people can relate to that. It's quite a universal thing, and it could be food or your phone or a relationship or whatever. So yeah, it felt good to kind of humanize addiction in that way and be like, it's not just this small group of people who can't handle their shit. It's all of us do that, you
There's
know?
So many variations of addiction.
Totally.
And that's what I liked in the show as well, was the honesty of that. It was clearly written from people who respect the subject and have experience in the subject, because it wasn't as black and white as here's the issue, here's the strict rules that you have to adhere to be clean or to be this or to be that. Because there are grey areas. There are points where your character and a sponsor have a drink somewhere. But they're not addicted to alcohol. But again, I think a lot of shows paint it as addiction is addiction. If you're addicted, then you can't have anything ever.
Yeah.
And it can become a really tough thing, particularly when you bring in, I spoke to Marcus Brigstock about this, you bring in, for example, food addiction.
Yeah.
Because that's an addiction that you can't go cold turkey on. You can't, or literally, but you can't just say, I'm not going to have anything, because you have to have something. And that's the nuance of addiction. The generally portrayed version on TV is you've got a problem, you join AA or NA, and you either relapse or you don't.
Yeah.
And if you relapse, it's a huge spiral. If you don't, it's not. And not to give anything away, in this there are kind of, there's wobbles here and there, but it's not necessarily always the catalyst or the trigger of now we're going off on this horrendous thing.
Yeah, and I think that's been true in my life. I'm a big supporter of like harm reduction therapies, where it's a little less. I go to NA meetings and stuff, but I definitely pick and choose what I take from those groups, and I still drink occasionally and casually, and so I think it's so different for everyone. So yeah, that's good. I'm glad that you felt that.
Do you know, I mean, this is completely not to do with the show at all, but do you know if it's intentional that they're called Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, and the first thing you have to do is stand up and say your name?
And say, I'm...
Is that part of it? It's just, I was thinking of it the other day.
That is weird,
it's anonymous, yet the first thing you do is...
Say your name.
Give over your anonymity. I don't know.
Yeah.
That could be the big, deep part of it, and intentional, but...
And I also think it's weird that you have to start. I mean, such a big part of it is saying I'm an addict and really identifying with that label in a way. And I don't know sometimes how helpful that is. So, you know, to be constantly telling yourself this narrative that you're you're an addict and that becomes a huge part of your identity. So I found that an interesting thing because you want to be vigilant about it. Yeah, you don't want to be like too cavalier,
yeah.
But you also don't want to be totally defining yourself that way. So I think that the character is struggling with that too.
Yeah, I agree. And it is really interesting. I had a mate who went to AA and stopped going because he was like, no, I'm not an addict. I'm not in as bad a place as the people there or this and that.
Yeah.
But in the opinion of some of his friends at the time, it was affecting his life.
Yeah.
You may not be locking yourself in a hotel room for 5 days on a binge, but it's affecting your life. So again, I think you're right there, is that the need in those situations to identify as a certain thing can make you move away from any resolution.
Yeah,
to what
totally.
Your issues are.
I think there needs to be more flexibility or to be, because yeah, you need to be able to ask questions about it, or else it becomes a little cultish. So you need to be able to say, wait, explain this to me. And isn't there some nuance here? Or yeah. So I think that's important, but I've also found those meetings really helpful. So, and a lot of people do, but it's like, yeah, it's interesting, isn't
it? Well, that's exactly it. It's our modern society's kind of need to have a fix-all solution to everything. That's going to be right for everyone. It's not.
Yeah.
What I like about your character in the show is you are dismissive of NA initially, and even at the end, you're still quite dismissive of a lot of it, but there's certain things that you've got from it. And as a show, it does that. It at points laughs at it, and then there's one particular point, particularly with the businessman guy, where it's really powerful and beautiful, and it's like, well, right, that shows how strong and important these things can be. So again, I like that, the nuance there, to go, we want to discuss this, but we don't want to just tell you it will fix everything, but we also don't want to just dismiss it. So was there a lot of challenge in finding the balance when speaking on LGBT subjects and addiction subjects, because they are such
hot button,
intimate,
like,
and personal as well. They are like hot topics, but also there's so much emotion and personal history attached to it by the people who are going through that.
Yeah.
So any representation, you don't want to trigger them. I hate that the word trigger has now been turned into an insult, but you genuinely, you don't want to affect someone in a negative way from your telling of this or approaching of this subject.
Yeah, I am, and I'm worried about that a bit. Yeah, we'll see what the reaction will be, because all I can do is do my personal experience with it and trust that that's all right and I'm allowed to say that. But I'm sure maybe some people will disagree with it.
Again, if it feels honest and respectful to me,
good,
and
okay,
it feels like it doesn't feel preachy. It's one of the things that I wanted to really get across on this podcast, that it's not some
agenda
pushing.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Because of the big subjects in it, obviously we're going to discuss those things a lot in a podcast, because that's what podcasts do. But I watched it very relaxed and enjoyed myself. It's not, it just happens to have these big topics in there that can hopefully then stem these kind of conversations. But it's not, you have to sit down and get through this lecture of a show kind of thing.
Yeah, I hope it's funny, and it's definitely just a love story as well. And like, I'm so romantic, so I hope that people just like really invest in the couple and want to see what happens to them and are rooting for them. But yeah, I think all the characters in NA, because like we know that addiction's not about just an addictive substance, because lots of people do drugs and never get addicted. So they're, all those people have something going on underneath that means that they're looking for that extra relief in their life. So I think that's sort of what it's about, people digging into that. You know?
Yeah, I love that. Again, the parallels, and it's touched upon with the kind of the quote you gave earlier, that the addiction can be to the addiction to love can be as strong as the addiction to cocaine
or to
the emotions and all these other things.
Yeah.
How was it kind of the casting of it all? Because the cast is amazing. Charlotte Ritchie.
Isn't she so good in this?
She's amazing. And Fresh Meat was one of my favourite shows.
Same.
And she's done some great stuff since, but this felt so good and she felt so natural and really real in it.
Yeah, I think she's so wicked in it. She's so vulnerable and... it's a side of her I think people haven't seen, and because she's so likable, that character can do like horrible things and you still are like, you know,
but again, it's the reality of it as well, because she is so likable, but then she'll say something harsh But you'll be sitting there as a viewer kind of thinking, yes, that needed to be said kind of thing, and things like that. And, it's a really...
Yeah.
She's great at that kind of, that kind of delivery, I guess.
And her timing is so good. We wrote with her in mind. And
brilliant.
Joe, my co-writer, went to university with her, and I met her in 2012, I think. And so we've been friends for a while. And so we did a pilot together, and that she auditioned for it. We had to do two auditions because the first one we couldn't look at each other and we're laughing so much. So everyone and the producers were like, "Oh well, obviously she can't be in this
because we make this."
Yeah,
show?
You can't keep it together. But then we did another audition and then the pilot, and then so by the time we came to the series, we were very much writing with her in mind, and we know what we find funny about her, and that helped a lot. And you can write really specific compliments about someone when you know who they are, and so that was great. And by the time we came to film, we got over all our nerves.
I was going to ask that because there's so much in the dialogue that is so specific, compliments-wise and joke-wise and insult-wise almost, of your two characters in particular, but all of the characters as well. So did you have a lot of the cast in mind by the time you were writing, or was there a lot that was kind of added down the line or on set?
We added a lot in rehearsals for sure. Yeah. And, but we had Lisa Kudrow in mind, but only as a fantasy.
Your mum is Phoebe from Friends. This is just the most, I mean, if you can see, that's a bit in capital letters on my notes.
Yeah. That's insane. Like, I can't believe
how must that be?
It's so surreal, man. I can't deal with it. It's insane. Yeah. It was just a fantasy. Like, it's just so much easier to write with people in mind. And I'd been watching The Comeback and, I just love her. And so we were like, oh, you know, someone quite commanding and keenly intelligent like she is, Lisa.
And that's what's been great of her roles since Friends, is she is the kind of, as you said, she's quite the powerful presence.
Like a
rather than the airy kind of Phoebe from Friends. There is a real dominance
like a steeliness, And then it makes you think what a character performance Phoebe was, because that's so not what she's like. So that was unreal. I couldn't believe she said yes, and then came to Blackpool for a week, and like she was eating all we had to offer her was digestive biscuits. Like, there was no craft services or anything, and luckily she was like obsessed with digestives, so she was like, these are delicious. And then she ended up getting really into the digestives. So
I love the you know, opening up Americans to the diversity of the digestive biscuit, that it can be a savory snack or it can be a dessert.
This is my new mission in life.
It can be all things. You can add some cheese or you can add some chocolate.
Absolutely.
It can go anywhere, that biscuit.
Dip it.
Yeah, exactly.
Give it to a toddler.
There's so much that can be done there. The other person that jumped out to me instantly was Al Roberts. I adore him in Staffelet's Flats. I'd never seen him in anything else before that, and he was wonderful. And in this, he's playing a very different character.
He's such a sleazeball, his
delivery, again, it feels like anyone else delivering his lines at times would seem just so ludicrous and unrealistic, because he says just some of the stupidest or most preposterous or offensive stuff. But you really believe that there's someone out there who would believe that is a chat-up line, or believe that is an acceptable thing to say to anyone else, let alone someone that you're trying to woo in any way.
He's so funny. He was in the pilot as well, and we knew we were desperate for him to, because he takes any line and just elevates it. Like, you're right, there's stuff that no one else could pull off. I think I used to live with him, and and then I lived with him in Edinburgh as well one summer, and I just think he's so funny. He's got such a unique way about him. And then he's such a funny improviser too. So there's stuff we had to cut that I wish we didn't have to cut. There's a line where he's trying to pick up George, my girlfriend. He's trying to like crack onto her, and he says, "I have a spare ticket to my uncle's podcast recording." And then, we cut. But someone said, "Oh, what's it about?" And he went, "Death." It was so funny and quick that he thought of that on the spot. Death.
And then
we did another take, and they said, "What's it about?" And he said, "My other uncle." So funny. Yeah,
it's amazing. How is that kind of when you're writing a show? Because it's something I think a lot, particularly about the comedy industry, is everyone knows each other. So
very when you're incestuous. Writing something,
or that's it, incestuous. And also, there'll be people that you're really close to who you've not put in. And that must be weird as well, because you must be thinking, well, I need to put my best friend in, but there isn't, it doesn't fit. So how is that kind of the benefit and the negative of knowing all these amazing characters, essentially, that you can just go, I can write it with Ali mind and it's perfect, but then, but what can I write for this person or for that person?
I know. You have to be really dispassionate and really just think about the characters. So there are only like Al and Jack Berry, who's one of the comedians, we really wrote with them in mind. And then everyone else, we just had a really brutal audition process.
Steen in there as
well. Yeah, Steen's in there.
Because that's it. The weird part is normally for my prep, I'll go through the IMDb as well to go, oh, that was that person. And it's not all up on IMDb yet. So I was really like, it made it a test for me.
Yeah.
Like, I know that person from somewhere. Oh, that's having to hunt them down.
But I think we also wanted to surprise ourselves with casting. So there are people like Tom Durant Pritchard plays Hugh in it, Binky's boyfriend. He's so funny. And I think our first instinct was to go with a comedian for that part. Yeah. But actually, he's such an amazing actor that he just plays the truth of that guy. So
The horrible truth of that guy.
Yeah. So there's loads of... And Ophelia Lovibond is just so good as Binky.
It's amazing because I've always kind of... I've discussed it on the podcast before, and I try to be as open as possible, but the one prejudice I still have to fight is posh people.
Yeah.
Because I naturally start off on the wrong foot, which isn't fair because some of the best people I know now are these wonderful posh people. But it makes it easy to write a villain of the piece as such, because these Binky and her partner, they're so outrageous, but also you know they exist.
Yeah.
You know they're 100% realistic and so regular in society. So it means that you can... Yeah.
Those are all...
Some of the things that Binky says are so horrifically homophobic and all sorts of things like that. But it's like, well, no, she wouldn't be aware of that.
No, she's not a bad person. She's just... They're in such a bubble, those characters. And those are all interactions that I've had, often with people that then become my friends or other comedians and things like that. Like, Binky saying that, you know, your hair is so funny, or like things like that that you don't think about. And they think they're being nice, but you're like, okay.
Thanks. That's really nice. So how was it kind of before all of this in real life May rather than TV show May?
Yeah.
How was it coming over to the UK and having to try and become part of the comedy scene, have a life that may involve the gay scene? How was that as a transition, and when was it a choice and decision that you made?
I was dating someone in Toronto who wanted to come over and do a master's degree here.
Right.
And I have a British passport. My dad's British. And my grandma was here. And so we said we'd go for 2 years. And then I became obsessed with it. She finished her degree and was like, I'm fucking off. And I was like, oh, I love it. I'll stay. And then so we broke up and I stayed. And it took a long time to find my social niche, I think. But luckily with doing comedy, there's such blurred lines between your social world and your professional
and work,
world. Yeah, because you're in a bar and it's nighttime. So
it's the same with podcasting. I'll realize that I've not spoken to anyone other than in podcast format for a week. But I've had these amazing conversations. I feel completely fulfilled socially in conversations. Like, oh, I don't know any of these people. They're just people I spent an hour really getting deep with, and then I've gone home and relaxed.
It's
a good combination.
Doing gigs, and you must feel you're like, but it's like, no, you were just speaking. It was a one-sided conversation with an audience.
Exactly.
But it feels like you've really got out of the house. Yeah,
that can be,
a
troubling thing. But so it all kind of, that helped you kind of.
Yeah, and I had, my dad grew up in London, and I went to school in England for a year when I was a kid, and we used to come every Christmas and every summer. So it wasn't a massive culture shock, but it definitely took a while. Like, I didn't know. When we first moved, we saw Reading on a map, and we'd found this cheap flat in Reading, and we were like, that's close to London. We'll just live in Reading and work in London. It didn't occur to us the reality of living in Reading and commuting to London. So things like that.
You could have just ended it as the reality of living in Reading.
Yeah, I almost did, and then I thought I didn't want to piss off Reading people.
But no, it is interesting because like when I've had – it's weird because it will have been the acclimatising to the British way that – made you realize how much of an issue that was, because all my American mates, like when we're touring and stuff over here, we'll be getting up going, oh, it's a 3-hour drive today for the next gig. And the American artists who tour America all the time will be like,
yeah, it's a flight.
It's a flight and then a car and then this and then that. It's like, so it is quite British to be, oh, come on, it's 2 hours out of London.
Yeah.
I can't be doing that. Or 90 minutes.
I can't be
doing that every day. And it's like, oh, actually, it's,
yeah,
it might be doable and balanceable.
And the sense of humour is the same. So that was easy, I think.
Is there a good comedy scene in Canada?
Yeah.
So were you already...
I was already doing
your,
it.
Your way there.
Yeah, like I started when I was 13 in Canada, so I'd been doing it almost 10 years already when I came here.
That's fantastic.
And then, but that's, Canada's a great place to learn, but unfortunately, it's just not the infrastructure and like financial support from the government and from a peripheral industry. So it's really like do it yourself, like comedians producing their own shows and tours, and there's no like help. So it's such a good place to learn, but then. Just the scale of it in London is crazy.
Yeah.
Can't believe it.
I mean, speaking of help, and this is a weird one here because it's something that I don't know the answer to, and it's something I'm weighing up a lot at the moment. The kind of the balance between, or conflict, I guess, between a representation, whether that be of genders, sexualities, of races, versus kind of companies cashing in on the pink pound, on these different things. And I think a Black Panther and Wonder Woman, things like that, are great examples of where it's a really blurred line, because I think they were both really important, powerful films for scenes. But I also think that Marvel and DC didn't care that much about them being this powerful thing. They just went, well, we're going to get a huge audience purely because it's the black superhero or it's the female superhero. How do you find that as a balance? Because it is obviously we are in a socially progressing time, so there will be people, particularly in places like Channel 4 and Netflix, who care about getting this diversity, but there will also be
like a cynical
areas that
kind
are going,
of...
yeah, well, you know, it's good for us, it makes us look good, or there's, we're always... As I say to my partner, brands need to learn that releasing, and they have learned now, but releasing vegan versions of their food is great because they don't have to spend any money on advertising, because all vegans tell other vegans when there's something new that's vegan. It's a real good word of mouth thing.
Yeah.
And there's similar things there in LGBT community. There will be, as soon as there's a new LGBT show, it will be spread naturally and organically rather than needing necessarily a huge marketing campaign. So how do you find that, or do you just go fuck it, I'm getting to make a show, I'm not going to question what everyone else's motives are?
I mean, we're still so early in this period where diverse stories are being told, that I'm like, I'll take it if I can get it. I don't care if there's some cynical businessman behind it, because it's still at the end of the day, as long as it's not, let's say, a group of straight businessmen who are like, we're gonna make a lesbian show, and then they make some bizarre misrepresentation, which happens, I think, because they're like, we got to take that, but they don't have any actual queer people behind it. So as long as it's authored by someone who has something to say about that subject, then I think it's great. I don't mind. I think it is still like, because there's so much conversation around it that we get someone said to me the other day, like, oh, you can't win any awards unless you're black and trans anymore. And I was like, I can't think of anything that's won an award that's black and trans. I'm looking at the BAFTA nominees. I don't know where that comes from. It's just because it's in the news a lot.
Actually, completely.
The reality is it's not like where you'll see people be like, oh, the awards nominees are dominated by women this year. That was some Edinburgh award thing, but it was like 3 out of 10 were women. But it was like, but they just said that they were dominant. You know what I mean?
And equally, people need to realize, because I spoke to Josie Long about this ages ago, because I was kind of saying it is a weird one, because I don't want to base any like booking of guests, for example, on anything other than they're an interesting guest.
Yeah.
But she kind of made a point, and I kind of, the way I reposition it in my head is, if you're a kid, this feels like I'm going on a really long weird tangent.
No, I'm with you.
But if you're an 8-year-old boy, and you've got your gang, and there's 20 of you, and it's boys only because girls are gross.
Yeah.
but each year say five people leave and you get five new people in each year. You turn at nine and one of the five new people is a girl, because there's this girl on the block who's just one of the lads. She's really good fun. She's cool.
Like me.
Yeah. So May joins the gang.
Yeah, I'm on my skateboard.
But then you get to like 12 and, you know, there's one girl and 19 boys still. And you're kind of like, man, actually, girls are really good. I like girls. The correct way to rebalance that isn't to go 50-50 on the new intake. The correct way to balance that would go, let's have five girls join.
Right.
So now we're still heavily in the male side. So it's not as simple as, oh, well, I've decided that we're now going to have equality, therefore we're going to employ an equal amount of boys and an equal amount of girls. If you're already heavily on the male side of things, then you need to push harder in that to get that representation and balance and equality. And that's where people, I think, get a bit confused or defensive.
Yeah.
Because they go, no, I'm not racist.
We're also
think everyone's equal.
Totally.
Yeah, but they're not allowed to be equal yet. They're not at a level of being equal yet.
Exactly. Like, we're in a transition period. So you can say, well, it should be a total meritocracy and it should be only the people that have the utmost experience. But we're right at the crust of centuries of oppression. So there aren't going to be the diverse people with that level. Sometimes I can't think of a specific example, but like then no, you know no, what I mean.
I agree.
Yeah, so you sort of have to proactively and think of all the people that you haven't heard about that are amazing because they just haven't, their voices haven't been amplified or whatever. So we are in this tricky time where it's very easy for people to be like, that's unfair that you know someone would get a job over me. But you've got to look at it in the context of human history, you know.
And again, in just if you look at a meritocracy, like again, people will argue now that you can't get a project made or off the ground if you're not gay, female, or a person of colour. And you kind of go, well, you know that for the last like 10, 15 years, the white males running all of this have just been remaking everything.
Yeah.
They're out of ideas.
Yeah.
That's why we need a variation, because we've got the third Ghostbusters reboot on its way. And it's like, you know, there's more and more. It's just, let's do the same thing over and over again. That's why we need diverse voices and more diverse stories, because the white male story has been told plenty and we've clearly run out. So
that's interesting. And also, I think it's totally not true that you can't get something away. But I think also, like, we're just trying to represent a more realistic cross-section of society. So if it's often just about, including, like, a sprinkling of diversity or to reflect your real life. Like, it's been so unrealistically white. Like, it's been shows where you're like, it's so unrealistic that there would be no... that everyone is white in this show, you know?
Yeah.
Sort of weirdly. So it's more like, oh, can we actually just reflect what the world is like, where someone would be gay at that office, someone would be black. Like,
and that's true representation.
Yeah.
And again, I think it's what you do well in the show, is where it's not your character's sexuality is one part of the story. It's not the main focus of the story. It's not the main focus of the struggle. It's just a natural thing. There's an actress I had on called Angel Jufria, who's only got one arm and has a robotic arm. It's the most amazing thing I've ever seen. It can spin round. It's got light. She does a lot of cosplay stuff and plays she covers it in blood all sorts of weird stuff. She's amazing. She's on social media. I recommend it. But she's an actress or an actress. And she was saying how she only gets cast as the amputee person.
Right.
And she got a role in something where she was just a waitress. And it was a tiny role, but it meant the world to her, because it wasn't amputee waitress or one-armed waitress. It was just waitress. And she happened to have a robotic arm. And that's where we need to get with all of these things. Have characters who, it's not their main defining feature that they're gay or that they're this or that. It's just that happens to be who they are.
Yeah. Because, like, no wonder people have this sort of... like, oh, it's going to be a trans character talking about being trans and stuff, because that's how it's being written.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it would be awesome if there were trans characters that didn't...
It wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, or like, yeah. So I hope we're trying... I mean, yeah, it's definitely a thread in the show, but I hope it's not like the main... Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pushing all the time for more characters who just happen to have a stutter, but that's just because I want more work.
Right, yeah.
And I can get my stutter under control, but it's easier not to.
Yeah,
so it'd be good if it was just a character who just happens to stutter on half the scripts I'm working on. Any role that I'm thinking is me is like, oh, by the way, he happens to have a stutter every now and then. We're not going to annotate it, but it will come up every now and then. It's not a big deal.
Yeah. That's a great idea.
So to kind of wrap things up, what's ahead, if you can even think ahead? Obviously, it's a project that you've been working on for 5 years.
Yeah.
It's not out yet. That must be all you're thinking of. But I think the beauty of working stand-ups is that you also have to just get on with your life. You can't just sit there and wait for this thing to come out. You will be gigging constantly and doing all these other things. Sia, what's the plan?
Well, you can't take your eye off the ball. Yeah, and I get rusty so fast if I don't gig. Yeah. So like tonight, I've been doing press all day for Feel Good, and then tonight I'm doing an hour long work in progress of a new show that I'm trying to develop and tour in like May and June try and I feel like I'm in a really weird limbo because I have no idea how the show will be received, and I don't know anything, so we'll see. I'll kind of go to LA and promote it, I hope. And like, I have another thing in development with Netflix that's like a sort of, I don't know if I can talk about it, but
that's
that'll
fine.
Be cool.
That's
yeah,
fine. Again, you know, it's that those handcuffs of things going even remotely well always means it's all stuff I'm really excited about, but I can't tell anyone about it at all at the moment. But
mainly I'd love to do more Feel Good. Feel like we've got more stories to tell with those characters, so I hope that happens. That'd be sick.
It's definitely exciting, because I think it is a time where, because of things like Netflix and people being willing to partner with Netflix, lot of the stuff that Channel 4 have done with Netflix has gone huge globally because of that, because of that availability all over the place.
I totally get what a tight spot broadcasters are in here, and because it's that competition from streaming platforms is so intense, but it is for artists amazing to get that level of exposure.
It's why, and again, I mean, we're sitting in Channel 4, so it's not really a topic to discussion to have, but it's why it's so annoying watching this debate about the BBC license fee at the moment, and people are wanting to scrap it, is they don't realise that fee funds so much stuff that wouldn't happen. It's been the education for so many people who go on to work at Channel 4, who go on to work at Netflix. So many directors, producers, everything come from the funding of the BBC to be able to get projects off the ground. But that's not what we see as consumers.
Yeah.
We go, well, there's only two shows I watch there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's four shows I watch on Netflix, so why can't it be subscription? But it's the same with a Channel 4, is you might go, oh, everything I watch is on Netflix now. It's like, yeah, but who's making those shows?
And yeah.
Who's making the first show of the person who made that show?
Yeah.
Who gave them their first break that they failed at miserably, and it was awful.
Totally.
Unwatchable. But they wouldn't be able to make the thing you love if they hadn't done that in the first place.
That's definitely the case with me and like BBC Radio 4 first kind of giving me a chance. Yeah. And then Channel 4. Yeah, totally. And I don't think that would happen in the States. You can't just go to Netflix and be like, I'm an up and coming. Can you give me some space to try shit out?
Yeah,
like,
just want to experiment.
Yeah,
kind of figure things out for a bit.
Yeah, whereas I remember the BBC sending me on like a writer's retreat where, you know, they send groups of writers and it was just like a weekend paid for where I got to sit and write with writers. I'm like, nothing like that happens in Canada. It was such a cool thing, and that's, I'm sure, the licensing fee.
Yeah, it must completely. But it's the stuff that people who argue about it online can't see. And any time you try and have a rational debate about it, they'll go, well, if it's so good, everyone will pay for it. If it becomes optional, then it's like, it's not the point.
No,
you won't.
You won't.
You're an idiot.
Exactly.
You don't understand the kind of the behind the scenes of it all.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of social media, where can people find you online?
On Twitter, I'm at the Mae Martin, and then...
And it's Mae spelled M-A-E
M-A-E. Yeah.
Just in case anyone...
Like Mae West.
...struggles really hard to find that complex code. Yeah. It's pretty easy to find, but yeah.
And then Instagram, I'm Hooray Mae. Yeah, hit me up, you know.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much
for taking your time,
particularly the end of a busy day and the beginning of a busy evening. So I really appreciate
being
completely asleep and being
excited and
engaging.
Such a joy, and you're so thoughtful and great. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Mae Martin. As you will have heard, I loved that chat. I felt it was the perfect length. I felt it was lovely. I felt we agreed on so much stuff. And I was just fanboying out a bit because, I, as said, this new show, Feel Good, I think it's awesome. I really, really do. So keep an eye out for that. And keep an eye out for next week's Distraction Pieces podcast with Niamh Algar. I will see you all next week. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.